Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is my good buddy, and he is going to absolutely blow your mind. On Twitter, his handle is MacroAlf. Alfonso, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my friend.
Thanks, George. It's always a pleasure to be here, and it's cool you didn't even try my surname. Well done. Don't even try.
No, I tell you, I go with the KISS strategies. You keep it simple, stupid, right?
Exactly. That works. That works. I mean, with my surname, there are many people butchering it. It's complicated. Let's stick with Alf. Alf works. How are you doing, George?
All right. Oh, and I'm wearing my t-shirt today because I got to do a better job of promoting my live event, which is coming up June 24th through the 26th, Rebel Capitalist Live. So if you want to check out speakers like Snyder and other guys that, you know, that we love talking to and gals, go to rebelcapitalistlive.com and check it out. I promised my digital marketing guy I'd be better at promoting for at least the next 30 days.
Yeah. Well, it will be my utmost pleasure to be there next time it's organized. I mean, the lineup must be just so good.
Oh, yeah. We got Kiyosaki and Doug Casey and Snyder and Joseph Wang, too. So we're going to have a panel discussion with Joseph and Jeff. Right. So that should be a lot of fun. But anyway, yeah, we'll definitely get you one coming up. Let's get into repo. You did a podcast with Emil and Snyder the other day where you guys really got into the nitty-gritty of rehypothecation. Mm-hmm. And I know that's something that confuses a lot of people, but they see it and just kind of viscerally, they know, okay, that's probably risky. So can you kind of walk through how that works and then maybe give a specific example like you did in that podcast where JP Morgan has, you know, balance sheet capacity. So they're going out, they borrow treasuries, and then they want to get a return on those treasuries that's higher than the yield. So they lend them out and maybe a reverse repo transaction. And then I've got further questions from there. So you just want to maybe outline it and start with that specific example.
Yeah. Let's rock about repo. Let's see if we can make it easier for the audience to understand this monster, right?
Yeah.
So where I always start with repo is I used to do it myself. So I was sitting on one side of the equation until 4 months ago, had a $20 billion book, had securities to repo out, or I could repo in securities in my book, right? Why do I do that in the first place? I mean, where the heck is the advantage for me as an investment portfolio manager to repo? And who's on the other side of the transaction, right? Where we say repo to whom? I mean, how does that work?
And also, when you're saying repo, you mean lend.
You have a security in your book. You have it there. You can lend it away. And you can get some form of money back, which is cash or a bank reserve. It depends who are you lending to. Is it either a bank deposit or a bank reserves? But why would you do that in the first place? So instead of starting from me, let's start from a pension fund. And so a pension fund has a bunch of assets, mostly bonds, but also equities, private equities, credits, all of that. But it also has an amount of bank deposits, right? I mean, a pension fund doesn't have an account at the Fed. It has an account at JP Morgan, for example. And so it deposits some of the bank deposits there. When QE happens, George, those bank deposits become bigger. Because if the Fed buys, as you explained very well in your whiteboard video, from a pension fund, it takes away the bonds, but then a pension fund will have bank deposits instead, right? I mean, ultimately, they don't have an account at the Fed. The best they can do with the proceeds of the bonds they sold to the Fed is to deposit at JP Morgan or Bank of America or another bank.
Right.
The interesting part is that these deposits are basically running credit risk. Anything above $250,000 in America is outside the FDIC insurance scheme, basically, on these bank deposits. Which, now let's think about it. It means a pension fund will have billions or a hundred of millions, whatever, deposited in the banking system in America. It yields nothing most of the times, very, very little. And it runs overnight credit risk. If Bank of America goes belly up, then the pension fund gets compensated only for $250,000. That's a horrible deal. It's a horrible deal risk return wise, right, for a pension fund. So what they will end up doing is, okay, so I have these bank deposits. Maybe somebody wants them. I would like to have some proper collateral that actually backs my overnight deposit. So what I will do is I will engage in a reverse repo transaction. It's a pension fund that will lend my bank deposits and I will source some collateral in. Some stuff that actually I'm relatively sure it runs very little credit risk. Something like a treasury bill, right? For example. Okay, cool. Now we understand who's on the other side of the repo transaction. There is somebody that wants to borrow the securities that I, as an investment portfolio manager in a bank or in a hedge fund or whatever, I maybe have on my book, right? The pension fund on the other side wants to avoid interbank credit risk. He wants collateral instead, like treasuries, something with much less credit risk. So he wants me to lend him my treasuries, right? And why would I do that on the other side of the equation, right? I'm the guy who has the treasuries in the first place. I'm a bank. I'm a treasury department of a bank. So I buy treasuries. The reason why I do that is because I can make some money in the meantime. Because if I can lend this collateral, I have to extend my balance sheet. And you touched on that before. If I have a bond today and then I lend it, I get bank deposits back. So my balance sheet has expanded. And for that expansion of balance sheet, I will hit leverage ratios. I will hit certain constraints. I will need to pay for that expansion of the balance sheet. I want to be compensated for that. And how I'm compensated for that is via the repo rates. Now, as you understand, there are two sides of the equation. A guy that wants to lend securities and has a balance sheet to expand, basically, but wants to be compensated for it. And a guy that wants not interbank credit risk on their deposit, they want the collateral against it. And that's how two parts meet in a repo, reverse repo transaction. And then there are hedge funds, just to finish the thing, and then you can go with questions, George.
The
hedge fund guys, they do all of this for other reasons. They do all of this because they need to do arbitrage trades. And so arbitrage trades are, for example, when a hedge fund buys a treasury and then pays against that a Fed funds future or a swap, or something that will be closely resembling a treasury security, but there is an arbitrage to be made. In case of the bond, when you buy a treasury bond, you buy interest rate risk and you buy credit risk, although we know that the treasury department can hardly default, but effectively you buy both. And if you swap away a hedge only the interest rate risk, sometimes you can find some dislocations, very tiny dislocations in the treasury market. And the hedge funds, if they lever up a lot and they can do that by a repo, they can exploit these incongruences basically that are in the markets. And those are the actors in repo and reverse repo. But now hit me with questions.
Okay. So going back to the pension fund, why would that would basically be a repo with a negative rate? Because they're paying you to borrow those. So basically they're paying you to lend you money. Cash to take those treasuries as collateral. So why would they pay to borrow the treasuries instead of buying the treasuries and then they're making at least a couple basis points?
Okay, that's a very fair question. And the answer is because in a reverse repo transaction, all they get is effectively a collateral backing their deposits. So they get away from the credit risk of having an unsecured deposit at JP Morgan or Bank of America. There, they run credit risk in the interbank sector. That's what they do. They basically are uninsured, depositing millions at Bank of America. If they want to hedge, basically, for that credit risk, they swap that in a reverse repo transaction and they get a collateral, which is treasuries. And therefore, they sort of are running a credit risk-free transaction overnight. And so they pay. They pay for that, right?
They have to pay for the treasuries.
Why not buy the treasuries? Because the treasuries are generally not only an instrument that prevents you from running credit risk overnight, but they also bear other risks. In that case, would be interest rate risk. If you buy a five-year treasury, right, and you stick it to your balance sheet, you are owning also interest rate risk, right? So you are adding another layer that maybe the pension fund doesn't need because it has another department doing that. It's an asset liability management department that looks at the pension fund liabilities over time. It's, you know, all the retirement accounts that need to be funded, all the pension contributions need to be paid over time. And then it buys certain bonds or corporate bonds to hedge the interest rate risk of the liability side. That's one department doing that. Now we're talking about the other department that takes care of sterilizing the credit risk of parking money overnight into the banking system. And for that, it's more optimal just for that sake to do a reverse repo transaction than just outright buying treasuries, which will add additional risks on the balance sheet of the pension fund, which maybe are not needed.
Got it. So just in case the listeners or viewers aren't following there, so you've got cash, which in and of itself is risky because you're way over the FDIC limit. So you want to get rid of as much risk as possible. Now, if you were to buy the T-bills with the cash, now all of a sudden you're swapping one form of risk for another form of risk, especially if you're buying not a T, you know, maybe a 3-month, but more so maybe a 5-year, 10-year, 30-year treasury. You can imagine the risk there, where if you just borrow that treasury, the risk is still on the balance sheet of the owner of that treasury. So you've got a way to have something, I guess, some sort of asset that has minimal, the least amount of risk by taking that cash, lending it, and then borrowing the collateral, even temporarily.
That is a perfect summary. And when you talk about how safe from a credit perspective is your money, I just tweeted today, I also put an article on the Macro Compass about it, that basically explains the different forms of money out there. And you do a great job explaining that as well. Bank reserves, bank deposits held by a pension fund, bank deposits held by a non-financial institution. Overall, you always have to ask yourself, whose liability is that money?
Right.
And so if a bank, an insured bank deposit is a liability of the commercial banking system, and therefore you're running credit risk on that. The treasury is a liability of the government, and therefore you're running credit risk of the government, which is denominated in their own currency. And, you know, it is arguably a much less risky proposition as a form of money that the pension fund would like to own. And therefore they engage in a lot of these reverse repo transactions just to sterilize the credit risk of the form of money they own.
Yeah. I mean, people ask me all the time on the comments and in Rebel Capitalist Pro and at these events like Rebel Capitalist Live, they say, listen, I've got $1 million, George. I've got $2 million of cash. I don't know what to do with it because I don't trust the banking system. We could have another GFC, or there could be all this systemic risk. And I'm like, if that's you, your best option is just to buy short-term T-bills and roll it over, because you'd rather have the counterparty as the government than JP Morgan or Wells Fargo. And it's kind of a big hurdle for a lot of people, because they're like, I don't want to own treasuries because there's a negative yield on it. And I'm like, yeah, but compared to cash, you'd rather have that counterparty.
You're totally right. And it's also the common mistake made by people that say that we already have a central bank digital currency today, because we're like, yeah, we already use digital bank deposits. We already use digital dollars, which is true. 97% of transactions are done in digital bank deposit format. But the digital bank deposit that we use today is a liability of the commercial banking system. The CBDC is a liability of the central bank that is vastly different, because the central bank is ultimately the financial arm of the government. So it's basically a liability of the government, the CBDC. It's a very different instrument. So always ask yourself, whose liability is my money? And if you just want to swap that risk, you're totally right. Just buy treasuries instead. Yes, negative real yields, but often less negative than a bank deposit, which already is an improvement, and it helps you hedging that credit risk at least.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got into some nuance by the viewer or the listeners, first and foremost saying, okay, these dollars are a liability of whom? What entity? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, maybe what motivates that entity, and does that entity have a P&L? Or a balance sheet that they even need to worry about, meaning that the Fed, the government, they don't care about a P&L. They're going to lose all, but Bank of America actually does. But now we can take it into the next level of nuance. And when we look at the balance sheets of the non-bank entities, which is what I call them in the real economy, I think you've got to try to figure out, are there more dollars on those balance sheets chasing goods and services, or fewer dollars? But then you also have to try to figure out the question of velocity. You know, where are those dollars actually going to be chased? Because let's just say that the M2 money supply increased by 25%, but all of those dollars went onto the balance sheet of pension funds. Well, those pension funds aren't out there buying cheeseburgers and insurance and used cars and gasoline. But if that 25% gets onto the balance sheet of the average Joe and Jane, although they're both non-bank entities, we've got a different equation as far as velocity and potential future consumer price inflation. And I know you do, you've got your own way of describing that, which is awesome. So could you go through that for the audience?
Yes. So I created basically an index that tries to calculate exactly what you described, which is the incremental amount of bank deposits sitting on the non-bank private sector in general. Yeah. And it measures not only the amount, if it's going up or down, but at which speed it's going up and down. That also informs a lot about whether we're going to have inflationary pressures, real GDP growth pressures or not, because it's the pace of change of this amount that matters as much as the direction. Now, the way I think about that is the following. So our long-term GDP growth drivers are very simple. It's the amount of people actively contributing to the economy, so the growth in the labor supply, and how productive are these guys, and how productive is the capital we throw at the economy. That's right. What it is. Right. And George, basically in the 80s, all of these components peaked. Labor supply actually started slowing down in terms of growth. So we still grow the labor supply, but by a tiny bit. From the 80s to today, the rate of change has been dramatically down. And if I look forward, it's even worse. So like we're talking about China had, I think, 700 million people in the workforce by the 60s. Then it went all the way up by 1 billion. So that's a lot by the end of the 90s. And the projection is that by 2040, 2050, they're going to be all the way back to 700 million. So we are reducing the amount of people that contribute actively to the economy. And China, Japan, Europe are bad cases. But if I look at the US, the labor growth is expected to be at 0% labor supply growth year over year. So we're not growing our labor force, even including immigration. Are we becoming more productive? So again, yes, we are. But is the rate of change of productivity going up? Are we becoming 3% more productive a year, 4%, 5%. That's not the case because QE and lower interest rates have caused a misallocation of capital. We have zombie companies around. We have a lot of leverage and that therefore it sort of stops productivity. Now you go to politicians and you're like, guys, no labor supply growth. Productivity is 1.5%. What are we going to do about it? Yeah, so we're going to print money. That's the answer. But not the bank reserves. We are going to print the money that the real economy can actually get their hands on. And those are the ones that you explain in your whiteboard and we just defined. Those are non-bank private sector bank deposits, non-financial private sector bank deposits. These are the money that I can spend, you can spend, George, the listeners can spend. And how do we print those? We print those by levering up the public sector and the private sector. So every time the government goes and does deficits, which means they spend without having the intention to tax back the private sector at all, what they're doing is they're doing a hole in their balance sheet. Literally, they're issuing the currency. They have this power. They're making a hole in their balance sheet and they're transferring these net assets to the private sector, to your bank account. This is the stimulus basically that we saw in 2020s, the stimulus checks, right? They're sending new net resources to the private sector. They are increasing your balance sheet. They're increasing your bank, spendable bank deposits. The other guys that are doing that are the banks. Every time a commercial bank makes a loan, it creates a new deposit. It doesn't use existing deposits. It doesn't turn reserves into loans. That's not how it works. It works that a bank, every time they make a loan, they produce new bank deposits. And so effectively, it's the private sector levering up by bank lending. So banks lend, which means somebody is borrowing up, right? That's the private sector. Or it's the public sector that says, I'm going to make a hole in my balance sheet and I'm going to send more bank deposits to you guys. Those two metrics are incorporated in my credit impulse. And it basically leads inflation, growth, earnings, anything with a lag of about 9 to 12 months. And it's very simple to understand why. If you, I, everybody have all of a sudden more spendable bank deposits, well, at some point we're going to spend some of those, right? There is a good chance that we are going to spend some of those. When we have less of these bank deposits, or even the pace of change in the increase of these bank deposits is slowing down, we are very likely to actually spend less. We're very likely to have less animal spirits, and therefore inflation is going to slow down and growth is going to slow down, et cetera, et cetera.
How, or does it matter who is buying the treasuries that Janet Yellen is issuing for the government to run those deficits in the first place? Because the way I think about it, if let's say the average Joe buys the $1 billion at the treasury auction, $1 billion worth of treasuries, he is swapping the dollars on his balance sheet for those treasuries that Janet Yellen is taking and then just giving to another, to the average Jane, let's say, and is, she is putting those dollars on her balance sheet. So the net amount of dollars has not changed because they just basically took those dollars out of the system and then put them right back in. Whereas if a banking entity bought the treasuries, then they're most likely using bank reserves. And then when Janet Yellen spends the $1 billion into the economy, now on net balance, we have an increase of the dollars on the balance sheet chasing those goods and services. So does that matter? And if it does, how do you work that into your model?
So that is a very good point, and it does matter to a certain extent. So the most bullish case for inflation and growth is where the Treasury Department makes a hole in their balance sheet, they send resources to the private sector. We have this accounting gimmick nowadays where we issue treasuries. But let's take to fund this deficit, but let's take a step back. When the government makes a hole in their balance sheet, we just said that the private sector, non-financial private sector, bank deposits go up. Okay, whose liabilities are these increased bank deposits, George? They are the liabilities of the banking sector.
Right.
Banking sector liability side has grown. What has grown on the asset side of the bank balance sheet? It's bank reserves. That's basically the accounting identity. They will have more bank reserves. So what happens in most cases is that these treasuries will get absorbed by the banks themselves, because by regulation, the regulators have forced banks to own about 15% of their balance sheet in liquid assets, as they're called, and they have made eligible, of course, treasuries as a very liquid asset, and bank reserves are also liquid assets. So treasuries, banks always have a choice whether to own reserves or treasuries, or some corporate bonds as well are even considered liquid assets. So banks will always have an incentive, as long as there is a reward for these treasuries that have been issued out there, to use the reserves, as you just said, and turn them into treasuries. They will always have this incentive to do so. There will also be other regulatory buyers, pension funds, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so, but the banks are buying from the non-bank entities, and that's increasing the dollar assets of the average Jane or Joe.
Exactly.
And then that's creating the dollar. Okay. Yeah.
And basically, because of this regulatory-driven incentive scheme, and because every time the Treasury does a deficit, it also increases the reserves in the system, because if it increases the deposits, then it also increases the reserves in the system by accounting identity. And because of the regulatory pressure on banks, pension funds, asset managers to buy bonds, in most cases, those newly issued bonds are going to be absorbed by the private sector itself. If they are not, by the financial sector itself.
Right.
If they're not absorbed by them, then it's you and I that have to buy treasuries, right? And in that case, you're right that we're basically swapping a newly created deposit into a treasury, which basically means we can't spend that into a CPI item in the basket that is in the CPI, which makes this newly created deposit less likely to bring inflationary pressures. Don't forget, though, that even if we bought treasuries, in principle, we could always try to pledge them against something else. You can always pledge your portfolio, even as a private citizen, to get a loan out of it. So here we go into the more weeds of rehypothecation, et cetera, et cetera. But generally speaking, you're right. If the private sector has to absorb that as private citizens, then the impact is much more sterilized than it is if the financial sector absorbs that, which happens to be the case in most times anyway.
Yeah, it's a fascinating process. I love going through the step-by-step, you know, what happens first, what happens next. I'm going to try to do that just quickly here to make sure that everyone is following what we're saying, or do my best to articulate this without a whiteboard. So what happens is Janet Yellen has the TGA, which is the Treasury General Account, and that's at the Fed. So that's a liability of the Federal Reserve. That's basically her checking account. Yeah. And these banks have these bank reserves, which are the assets that match up their liabilities, which are the average Joe and Jane asset, those dollars that you have in your Wells Fargo account or something. So she issues the $1 billion, the average Joe buys that. And what happens is his dollar assets are reduced by $1 billion. Therefore, the liability of the commercial bank that he works with, those are reduced by $1 billion, but they have to send those $1 billion worth of assets to the bank somewhere. So they send them into the TGA. Mm-hmm. So now Janet Yellen has those bank reserves. And then when she spends the money, then it goes back into the reserve accounts of the banks for the average Joe, whoever received the checks, and then their liabilities go up as well. Now, what happens also is if the banks need to buy treasuries, and they could buy those treasuries from the average Joe that bought them in the first place, and then by swapping those treasuries for newly created dollars, the amount of dollars in the real economy would increase as well. So I think I did an absolutely horrible job. I know you understood what I said, but I don't think anyone else did. So I'll have to make sure that next week I turn that into a whiteboard video, because I think everyone would get a kick out of it.
The latest whiteboard you did on bank deposits and bank reserves and bank deposits held by financial sector, the private sector, was just awesome. So if you do one where you start from fiscal deficits, I think that helps people a lot to understand how that works to it. It's important because people always assume that fiscal deficits are crowding out the private sector. But in most cases, fiscal deficits are just a net transfer of wealth to the private sector, because the financial sector, by a lot of these accounting tricks you were talking about, basically absorbs the issuance, or is strongly incentivized to absorb the treasury issuance, which leaves the private sector immune from this, and it just basically sends them more net wealth on their bank account. It's important for people to know that. So watch out for the next whiteboard video.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I've been trying to think about inflation. Before I get there, let me get your thoughts on kind of the numbers that just came out. Number one, productivity, I just saw yesterday, went down for Q1 by something to the effect of like 7.5%. So although we may be up for the year, for this quarter, we had our lowest decline, or our biggest decline in productivity since 1947. Just going back to your earlier point. And then the labor force participation, I don't know that it's an all-time low, but it's definitely going lower. That's one of the reasons why the unemployment rate is at, you know, whatever it is, 3.6 or something like that. People get all excited, the talking heads on CNBC, the unemployment rate is 3.6%. But if labor force participation is going down, then we're being far less productive. And I think you see that in the productivity numbers and also the trade deficit numbers. You know, we're producing a lot less stuff, therefore we've got to import more. And the thought experiment I use for people there, let's just say we had 350 million people in the United States, and there was only one person in the labor force, and they were working. Well, we'd have zero unemployment, but yet how productive would our economy be? You know, we wouldn't be producing a lot.
That's pretty much.
We got a great unemployment rate, you know. So, and then I'd like to get your thought on that. And then also today, just about an hour ago, or maybe a couple hours ago, the CPI came out, and we go from 8.5 down to 8.2. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on all of the recent data.
Let's start from the inflation print first. I think a lot of people are looking at the wrong side here. So year-on-year numbers are obviously skewed by base effects. So all complicated, but what it means is that you're comparing yourself to April 2021, where you had a lot of rise in a lot of these base items in the CPI basket. So you had, I don't know, energy going to the roof on a year-on-year basis or whatever other components are very, very skewed by these base effects. And it's Powell himself who told you in the last press conference that he's focusing more on month on month, because it obviously is less skewed as a metric. You just measure against last month, and therefore things are much more nuanced there. And so if you look at inflation print, George, the month on month core services inflation is actually the highest it has been, well, in a while. It's like 0.6% month on month core services, which means X energy. It's only the service sector, X the volatile side of the service sector, which basically it's shelter. I mean, shelter and owner equivalent rent and all these measures of housing costs, etc. They have started to move up. On an annualized basis, we're like at 6% there. And it's a large, sticky part of the inflation basket. It's not like you make that measure go down easily. You don't achieve that, which what I'm trying to say is that all the used cars, the vehicles, all the very volatile goods services, goods part of the equation is actually coming down a bit, and that's natural. But what's coming up, and people should pay attention to that, is the sticky part of the inflation basket, is the core services part of the inflation basket. And that is a very hard part to bring down. I mean, the Fed really has to make an effort to make sure that goes down. Now, if you look at month-to-month core inflation overall, we have surprised to the upside all the Bloomberg estimates from like 70 economists. Neither of those predicted month-to-month core inflation to be as high as it was. So it is true we have peaked on a year-on-year basis, but that was to be predicted. I mean, geez, if we don't peak on a year-on-year basis, we're already at 8.5%. I mean, where do you want to go? But here people should focus on two things: the composition of the inflation basket. So it is sticky components or not that are contributing to the inflation. They should look at month-to-month rather than year-on-year. Most importantly, they should look at the pace of deceleration in inflation. There is this concept in finance, which is often misunderstood. The pace of change matters as much as the direction. Now, the Federal Reserve told you they're going to hike to 2 or 3% because they're contingent to inflation slowing down to about 4% by year end. If inflation doesn't slow down to 4%, but it slows down to 5%, the Federal Reserve will have to step up massively in a nonlinear fashion to make sure that inflation expectations remain anchored. It's not like if inflation slows, job is done. It's the pace of inflation slowing, it's the component of the inflation basket you should pay attention to. And here in this report, we got the pace of slowing, which was mediocre compared to expectation, was much of a slower slowdown than expected. And also, if you look under the hood, the sticky components of the inflation basket are actually going up and not down, like shelter, for example, which in my opinion makes the Fed pretty nervous. And Biden, he just went to the wires immediately after the inflation report saying, the inflation situation is still very serious, and I expect the Fed to do their best to achieve the objective to slow it down in a proper way. Now, what does that mean is that these guys will have to step up, right? So that is my first comment on the inflation figures. And the second on the unemployment rate, you're perfectly right. Like, people look at unemployment rate and they forget that it basically ignores, or actually the labor force participation rate drop helps unemployment rate to be visually lower, right? But if you look at the broader measure of unemployment rate, like U6 rather than U3, you start including marginally disattached people, part-time workers, not because they like to work part-time, but because they don't have an alternative, and all this broader definition of unemployment, you start seeing in the last report that it actually ticked up for the first time in a while. So it's the participation rate going down is a big damage structurally to the economy, because as you said, you send a bunch of potentially active workers. They could belong to the labor force. They actively choose not to belong to the labor force. They retire. They don't actively contribute to our economic output, which is not a great thing, I would say.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today.
Yeah, so that's, I'm glad you talked about looking under the hood first and foremost, because when I saw that the number go from 8.5 down to 8.2, I thought, well, maybe that gives the Fed a little bit of a reprieve, you know, where at least it went down, for heaven's sakes. And if they could continue to kind of talk down the stock market, maybe that translates into the CPI continuing to go down because of a decrease in purchasing power. Because I think the 401k and the home equity is a massive component of overall purchasing power and aggregate demand in the United States. So I thought that maybe, you know, the Fed could be trying to manage the CPI through the stock market. But that's because I just looked at the headline. I didn't realize that those sticky components are still increasing.
But George, you're right. I mean, what this makes them do, in my opinion, is to be even more aggressive on the reverse wealth effect, as I call it. So people always forget that the real estate market is by far the biggest asset class in the world. It's not the equity market. It's not the bond market. It's the real estate market. If you want to hear numbers, $300 trillion is the estimate global residential and agricultural and commercial real estate market, $300 trillion. The equity market globally, it's about a bit more than $100 trillion. It's three times smaller. And why that is the case is because the real estate market is a hugely leveraged market because of the mortgage market, right? And so it therefore represents a very large portion of the wealth effect that has been created over the last 40 years by making borrowing cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and therefore house prices higher and higher and higher because people can just afford borrowing more. As interest rates were lower, their installment was also not going up, right? And so that made all this wealth effect and house prices look sustainably higher. It represents a lot of the wealth effect that makes people be, you know, more buoyant when it comes to spending. If your 401k is to the roof, plus your house prices are 30, 40, 50%, two times larger, then you're going to be probably be spending a bit more, right? You feel more comfortable with your balance sheet. And now the Fed is like, okay, now I don't want you to be comfortable with your balance sheet. I want you to slow down. Because don't forget, I mean, inflation is a demand side. And we talked about the amount of bank deposits on the non-financial private sector, but there's also supply side, right? And now we've got a lot of these supply bottlenecks. The Fed can make the ships at the port of Shanghai load faster. They can't make China change their mind on the zero COVID policy. They can't make Russia and Ukraine stop the war so that Ukraine can export wheat and soybeans and all of that. They can't do that. What they can do is act on the demand side. And to act on the demand side, especially if you see sticky core inflation, like shelter inflation, the first thing you do is you try and slow down the housing market, right? And well, look at mortgage rates. 30-year mortgage rates, 5.6%. So what this is telling you is that they are actually working actively on slowing down the real estate market. Because if you make the same money you made a year ago, in real terms, George, you make less because inflation has been eating away your purchasing power and your salary has maybe gone up in nominal terms, but not in real terms. Right. So in real terms, you make less than a year ago. House prices are 20% higher than a year ago still. I measured us today. Your mortgage rate is not 2.9% anymore, it's 5.6.
Yeah, double.
To translate that into your mortgage installment, it's 50% higher to buy the same house. You can't afford it. Well, great, says the Fed. So you're not going to buy the house. You're actually going to force sellers to lower their prices, which is going to make the sellers less buoyant about their balance sheet because their house is worth a bit less than they thought, right? So it's the reverse wealth effect we talked about. And the first market you target is the biggest market, the most levered market. It's the real estate market, obviously. And it is also the one that has second round effects on the CPI basket via rents. Because don't forget, the shelter is also based on rent equivalent prices. So if house prices drop, then rents probably will not go up anymore. So you achieve actually two results, the wealth effect, the reverse wealth effect, and also by second round effects, you slow down rents, which means you slow down that sticky part of the CPI basket. On top of it, you go after the equity market because you make valuations much less buoyant. You tell people, here you go.
You're less purchasing power for homes too, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, basically. Your 401k goes down, you have less purchasing power to buy the house in the first place by selling stocks that may have been at all-time highs, as an example.
And this is the first time, George, in whatever, since I follow markets, where I can see that if financial conditions tighten, which is a complicated jargon to say, credit spread widen, equity is lower, the dollar stronger, housing market slows down. That's what it means, which basically hits your balance sheet from all angles you can imagine.
Yeah.
And then I can, the first time I see that a central bank is actively cheering for financial conditions to go tighter. We are used to see the opposite. We're used to see at every drop, central banks be like, no, we have your back. Just go and buy risk asset, right? We need this wealth effect to feed. We need you to spend some more. We need some inflation. This is the first time in a while. It's the exact opposite. Right. It's like every time the S&P rallies, I can see Powell be like, no, that's not what I want. Can you imagine that? I mean, this is just unprecedented. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I know. And then also, too, them trying to bring down the housing market slightly, that takes a long time. That is not like the stock market. So that's an even tougher tightrope for them to try to balance on, because you could just go back to the GFC. And we peaked out in 2006. It took us 2012, so 6 years, to get down to the quote-unquote bottom. And what happens, as you probably know, and I know this because I'm kind of a real estate guy myself, is the sellers always think they can get what their neighbor sold for. And they're always trying to hold out for that price, right? So if you got a house that's $500,000, or your neighbor sold for $500,000, you're always telling yourself that your house is better, even though it's the exact same floor plan. Oh, well, I've got hardwood floors or something like that, so I should be able to sell for $550,000. And then you get this thing, this price in your head. And then before you even sell, you've already spent the money. So you get like emotionally attached to this sales price. And then if it doesn't sell for 3 or 4 months and you read on you see on CNBC that the market is soft, you've got your real estate agent, blabbing in your ear that, oh, it's just temporary. The market's just gone down. It's just taking a bit of a breather before it starts going back up again. So you continue to hold. And it takes you like a year or a year and a half of prices potentially flatlining or going down before you come to the realization that, wait a minute, maybe we're in a bear market. And then everyone realizes that at the same time, you have prices really start to slide. But my point there is, it's not like the stock market where it can go down by 50% in a month or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And that makes it a system. It is the biggest asset class in the world. It is the most systematic out there. It sits on basically everybody's balance sheet. It represents a large portion of the wealth effect accumulated. It is also the slowest machine to react to all of that, because it needs rates to go higher, then it needs builders to actually give up on building because there is no demand anymore. But then it needs the sellers to give in as well. It means the supply has to come back to the market, which has been tight for a while. Then it needs, you know, this loop effect. It takes years literally to achieve that. But hey, if you are the Fed and you have to tighten financial conditions, then you're going to start somewhere. So, the equity market is already down 15% year to date, right? And then you see the most speculative side of the equation, like ARK or Bitcoin, or all the most speculative side of the equation tumble a bit more than that. But those are very reactive asset classes. The beast is the housing market, which has really been buoyant for years, and it's been fueled by lower and lower real mortgage rates. At some point in 2021, we had consumer inflation expectation, George, which were 3%, around 2.7% for the long term. That was the Michigan survey of consumers. So they go ask us, like, where do you expect inflation to be? We were like 2.7%. We had mortgage rates at 2.8%, 2.9%, 30-year mortgage rates. What that meant is that a consumer effectively thought as if they could borrow at 0% real rates, real mortgage rates after inflation that eats away your liabilities for 30 years. I mean, can you imagine that? It's basically no real cost to borrow. Literally, you're paying nothing in real terms. That's what the consumer thought. And obviously, when you reach that level, I mean, it's just a festival of borrowing and trying to just buy an asset that is also supposed to appreciate as inflation goes up, because land appreciates, the bricks appreciate, you can make a return on renting it out. I mean, that's the bonanza of the real estate market. And now we are just reverse engineering the process where you look at 30-year mortgage rates are 5.7%. I mean, and if you ask consumers, what's your long-term expectation for inflation? It has gone up, obviously,
right,
but it's still 3.5%, which means the real borrowing cost expected is now 2%. And it doesn't seem a lot of a change, but 2% on a lot of leverage, it is a significant impact on your ability to borrow and to afford houses. You just can't afford them anymore.
Yeah. And just to be clear there, you're talking about inflation expectations compared to or instead of the actual CPI number, because if you just look at the CPI number, obviously we got negative rates. We got negative real rates, you know, where you're actually being paid to borrow, but it's about expectations.
You're right, because you borrow for 30 years and then you pay a nominal mortgage rate for 30 years. So you have to assume your inflation expectation over the long term, right? You can't just look at today's CPI and say that is it. But in your in your decisions, you're going to incorporate your expectations about inflation too. If not consciously, then subconsciously, you're going to do that anyway. And so we are now seeing the reverse of that. And it's, I don't think that the Fed can just stop doing that. And we are in this crazy situation where if the Fed tries to blink and says, well, we want to stop the bleeding, right? We want, you know, you guys are too much ahead of yourself. We can't see the S&P go down 20%. If they say that, they're basically saying they're not going to hike that much. They're going to basically, you know, be much more soft. Well, the bond market is not going to like that, I can tell you, because inflation is extremely high. And if you as a central bank do not put yourself in front of the curve, do not show proper commitment that you want to slow this down, you will be punished. The bond market will start to really get nervous.
Yeah.
And we have seen a bit of the first reaction of that. Like, you know, 30-year treasury is 3.25%. It's been a while we haven't seen the very long end of the curve trying to, you know, signal to the Fed that, hey, guys, you got to be serious about this or otherwise we will get worried that you can't get this under control. And so long end bond deals, we will start to punish those as well.
It's all about the expectations. Expectations policy, I guess.
Yeah, it's really, you have to be credible here as a central bank. Inflation expectations have gone up. Like 5-year inflation expectation were 3.5% in America. 3.5% is way above the Fed target. Well, on the macro compass, I also shown, if you look at the distribution of these inflation expectations, and so you ask people, what do you think is the tail risk here? So 3.5 was the mean of the distribution. That's where on average traders expect inflation to be over the next 5 years. Ask them, what is the probability that the Fed will actually bring inflation to 2%, which is their job. I mean, you should be very confident they're able to do that. Do you know how much was that? It was 10% probability priced in.
Yeah.
That was scary. If you're a policymaker, you're like, whoa, nobody believes me. And the biggest asset of a central bank is credibility.
Right.
If they lose on that, then they're losing everything and they can't afford that. And that's why now I think they will have to step up their rhetoric even more at this point. Because credibility, it is the most important asset for a central bank. And they have already lost a lot of that, if you ask me, over the last year and a half. And now they're at a tipping point where financial markets are telling them, hey, guys, please get your act together.
Yeah, that's a fascinating take. But, you know, I want to go back to the real estate market momentarily. Because, you know, I didn't say this at intro, most people know who you are, but you managed a $20 billion fund not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've always tried to think through is what it would take to get, I can't remember if it's Blackstone or BlackRock that holds all the real estate. I think it's Blackstone that holds all the huge private equity that bought up all these rental properties, you know, single family starter homes in the United States. And I always tried to think through what it would take for them to liquidate, to start to say, hey, we need to sell ASAP, because that changes the supply equation dramatically, you know, because the price is really set at the margin, because so many people as own the housing stock, they're not selling, right? At any given time, only a very, very small percentage is for sale. So if you've got huge funds, you know, saying, okay, we need to sell all our rental properties back into the market, what would create a catalyst? And I always thought, well, maybe it's the 10-year treasury going up to a point that's close to the yield that they're getting from those rents. And even if it gets close, they'd choose the 10-year treasury because you don't have to worry about tenants and toilets, right? And property managements. But I want to ask you as a fund manager, because you know that mindset.
Yeah.
What do you think it would take for them to start liquidating everything that they've purchased?
You're a smart guy, George. You asked the question and you replied already. So I agree. I mean, it is, if you look at how these investment committees work in these big companies where I was before. So you sit with other large head of investment portfolios within the firm, chief investment officer, the chief risk officer, all these big guns, right? And what they look at is two things. A, are their shareholders worried? Can they save? Do they have to save face? Do they have to show they're doing something? They're de-risking. That is extremely important as a decision-making factor. If they feel pressure from the shareholders, if the shareholders are telling them, guys, you're making holes in your balance sheet, we can see the capital losses, even if you don't realize them, because there are a lot of accounting tricks in these asset managers and banks. If they don't sell the asset, in most cases, the loss isn't realized in the P&L, but it's only in the capital. So it's like it's reserved as a loss of capital, but it's not in the profit and loss statement of the company. But if the shareholders start to say, hey, this is the use you're making of my capital, you're blowing a hole through your balance sheet, and I don't like that, I think we should de-risk here. That is one of the factors. It's basically difficult to measure. It's the pressure they get from shareholders. The second is cost opportunity. And you said it perfectly. I mean, most of these rental yields are locked in at 5%, 4.5%, 6%, these sort of rental yields that they were able to achieve by buying at pretty cheap prices with hindsight that were basically due to low real borrowing costs, real mortgage costs. And now they lock those in and then they can rent it out and they have cash flows in the 6% area, 5% area. One thing, I mean, those are extremely attractive risk premiums if the treasury yield is at 1%. The treasury is at 4%. They're not that attractive anymore. You might get your chief risk officer, the other guy on your right, which is telling you, okay, so you in mark-to-market terms, if I look at the potential loss in your position, it's showing a loss, right? And then I look at the historical rental yield you have locked in. But now I look at your alternative asset, which is a risk-free asset from a credit perspective, and it's very close. So shareholders are putting pressure as well. I don't see the risk reward anymore in being in a risky asset for that much risk premium locked in. Why don't we switch back? Mm-hmm. And that actually is quite a driver. And it is one of the easy ways to reprice the entire risk premium. What you do is you think of risk assets in building blocks. So at the beginning of the building block, you have your most liquid, closest to risk-free asset. That's a treasury bond. It's a T-bill or a treasury bond. Or your repo rates. I mean, those are the backbone. And then you have investment-grade corporate bonds. And then you have rental properties. And then you have junk credit spreads. Then you have equities. Then you have, you know, the entire ladder, right? If you move the very, very base of the capital structure and you make that yield, instead of 1%, you make it 3 or 4%, you will immediately change the composition of the risk premium into the entire structure because it's all relative to what is the risk-free return you can generate, right? If you're an institution or you're a private citizen. And that is a very easy way to reprice by a so-called portfolio rebalancing effects. So you answered your question already. That together with the pressure you can get from external shareholders, that is the main reason why you start making changes in those rental properties. But you also said it before, the rental market, the real estate market are very slow to react.
What do you think would have to be going on psychologically with the investors? And what do you think would trigger that psychological response for them to call that manager and saying, you need to get rid of this real estate now, or I'm pulling my money. Would that need to be? I mean, I'm just trying to put myself in the position of an investor, you know, where when I would make that call. I mean, you've had the investors. What do you think would trigger that response?
Okay, let me tell you. So in 2016, there was a referendum in Italy where basically the prime minister back then, I had a chance to talk to him and he had promised pretty publicly that if he lost that referendum, he would just resign because it would make no sense for him to, you know, run for campaign or keep on governing if people wouldn't vote for that piece of policy. And so people are very nervous about politics in Italy because we have, you know, an election every year and a half. It's a very unstable country. And As you well know, Europe is a horrible architecture when it comes to fiscal and monetary policy, because we have, you know, fiscal policy all over the place and monetary policy set by one central bank for 19 different jurisdictions. And Italy sits at the very weak part of that intersection, right? So every time there is political dilemma in Europe, then there is always this, in Italy, there's always this rumor of, is Italy going to try and exit from the Eurozone? Maybe they're better off. And all the investors get extremely nervous, like extremely nervous. And so, you know what happened? We had this referendum. And of course, as you know, we were running also positions in Italy as any other European bank. And of course, there was a lot of risk priced in already. It was the night before the referendum. So imagine everybody nervous, all the risk being priced in already. You get a call, right? And they're like, get out. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? It's all priced in. I mean, it's this is the most horrible risk reward moment to get out. It's all priced in. We only have upside if actually the referendum turns to be positive. But there was no reasoning. There was a rationale into that. George, you had to get out. You get a call, get out. Because the shareholders are putting pressure, the CRO can't take it, you get out. And that's it. You just get a pending order, a marching order, it's called in the military. Right. So for the real estate market in the US, it needs to be something that is a reputational thing. So it doesn't happen like, oh, you get a report that house prices are down by 3% this quarter. No, that doesn't work. It's not that much because—
I think it goes back to expectations. If there's a psychological shift where all these investors think that the real estate market is going to go down indefinitely, that's your catalyst.
Like you don't want to be the first to get out because you can look like an idiot. You don't want to be the last to get out because you then probably are bust because of all this leverage and all that. You want to be more or less in the middle getting out so you can justify to your shareholders, look, we do our risk management assessment, blah, blah, blah. But we are not heroes that will get out because, you know, we still believe it's fine. That is more or less it. So it actually takes some time. The whole process is slow, but people should watch out because the Federal Reserve wants to slow financial conditions to tighten them. The real estate market is an obvious candidate that also, by a second round effects, lowers the sticky shelter part of the services inflation. They want to lower inflation anyway. It achieves a lot of objectives. And people have been conditioned to think that the real estate market only goes up. That's what we have seen basically relentlessly since the 2011-12. Basically, it's 10 years. If you have a real estate in your portfolio, it goes up 10% a year. It's as simple as that. I mean, that's it. People are conditioned to think about that. But also the real estate market has cycles. And now if the Federal Reserve manages to bring inflation down fast enough to 3%, then at some point they can just take the gas, take the pedal off the gas when it comes to slowing down things. And so we can take a breather. But if they don't manage to do that, then you seriously have to wonder about where real estate prices are going here.
And that incredible story and just awesome, awesome insight that you don't get every day. That's tremendous value. So I know we're running short on time, my friend. Can you tell my viewers and my listeners how to find out more about what you do and your blog and all these incredible insights that you post online?
Yeah, too kind, George. So I publish a newsletter. It's free. There is no charge. Just go there and subscribe. It's more or less once a week. It's called The Macro Compass. The URL is themacrocompass.substack.com. And there what I do is I just try and give my financial insights and some pieces of financial education here and there, some investment ideas as well to the people who want to subscribe. I just want to share the knowledge I've been lucky enough to accumulate running this large portfolio. And it's a learning journey. I mean, we share things with each other. You comment, I answer. You ask me a question, I answer. Try to build a community out of it and share a bit my knowledge. And otherwise, you can go on Twitter. It's at MacroAlf. That's my handle. And there I publish snippets. It's Twitter. So we just, you know, ramble with each other over there. And those are the two main channels to follow me.
All right. Well, thanks for your time, Alfonso, and I can't wait to do it again.
Thanks, George. Always a pleasure to be here.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Do you enjoy watching these interviews I do for the Rebel Capitalist show? Well, if so, you would absolutely love Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the conference I do twice per year, and we've had speakers like Robert Kiyosaki, Lynn Alden, Rick Rule, Jeff Snyder, and Dr. Ron Paul, just to name a few. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com and check out the next event we have scheduled in Miami. Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.